Remember when education was about the fundamental skills of reading, writing, and arithmetic, and about reading great literature and studying history to give our kids a model for what it is to be a good person? Memoria Press's classical Christian curriculum offers that very model for your homeschool. Get $5 off your next order by using the coupon code LPR20. For more information, go to memoriapress.com. Memoria Press, saving Western civilization one student at a time.
It's very childish because much in the gay community, like if you don't fully embrace what they're about, it's almost like a six-year-old child who goes, well, then you hate me.
It was a powerful thing that I, from the United States, a white man pastor, would celebrate the Lord's Supper and drink from the common cup with my black brothers and sisters there in Africa, and was unafraid to do so.
This is us, Todd. We're running, and Jesus is there, the author and the finisher of our faith, and he's waiting to catch us as we fall across the finish line.
Northern Illinois cops refusing to enforce the governor's orders against churches, love issues, etc.
Well, it started with an op-ed piece in the New York Times written by a U.S. senator. I think it was titled Send in the Troops. I think editors probably write those titles for the op-ed pieces, not the authors themselves. And within a day or two, there were major resignations at the New York Times. In particular, the editorial page editor stepped down. And some people say that the monkeys are now running the zoo, or that the lower-level staffers are somehow making demands and having all of them met by the leadership of the New York Times. What has happened to the New York Times? Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. live on this Wednesday afternoon, June the 10th. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. We're going to be talking with Terry Mattingly about media coverage of recent resignations at the New York Times. A little later, higher education post-COVID, Eric Hiller will join us, managing partner of Hiller Associates, a consulting firm that specializes in product cost management. He's also authored a column for MarketWatch on coronavirus and higher education. Abigail Schreier joins us after that from the Wall Street Journal. We're going to talk with her about the double standard of stay-at-home orders. Churches told to keep their numbers down. In the meantime, the streets are full of people. Then we'll do listener email and the Issues Etc. comment line. The comment line number 618-223-8382 and the email address talkback@issuesetc.org. Joining us to talk about media coverage of recent resignations at the New York Times, Terry Mattingly, senior fellow at the Overby Center at the University of Mississippi, author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate and the book Pop Goes Religion, and founder and editor of Get Religion. Terry, welcome back.
Glad to be here.
I know that we've discussed this before, but is it now accurate to say that the New York Times is openly liberal?
It certainly is way closer to that, but I think we need to begin, and I know you, this probably drives you nuts, but we have to back up here a bit and remind listeners of how we got here, because when we say something like it started with an op-ed, in terms of what Get Religion has been covering now for, you know, 17, 18 years, and in terms of what you and I have been discussing here on these broadcasts, this really isn't all that new. In fact, when you saw this happen, Todd, what was your reaction? What was your honest reaction?
Well, my honest reaction initially was that it was a very coordinated effort on the part of the staffers at the New York Times on Twitter. They all essentially posted exactly the same thing about Senator Cotton's op-ed piece there, and I thought, well, the memos must have gone out to everybody. This is how you react.
Well, they had done this before with a couple of headlines, and I think listeners need to understand how genuinely strange it is to have a revolt among the hard news staff, the people in the newsroom, not the editorial pages, and you're supposed to have this separation wall between the editorial pages and the newsroom to show that they're independent of each other. And normally what that means is that the fact that the op-ed page and the editorial pages get to take political stands, that's not supposed to influence the coverage of the normal straight news objective, not to a term worth debating, objective reporters. So do you see how genuinely bizarre it was to people in the industry to see people in the hard news staff lead a revolt against one of the nation's most liberal, and there's another word we need to discuss, liberal editorial pages, attacking it for printing a rare example of a contrary view against the doctrines of the New York Times. Hard news reporters revolting against the opinion pages for printing the wrong opinions is just not what is supposed to happen in an American model of the press newspaper. And of course, listeners, American model of the press is the classic old school approach to journalism born in the mid 19th century and into the early 20th century that basically says you're going to try to treat people, institutions, ideas on both sides of heated controversial debates. You're going to try to cover them with accuracy, balance, fairness, and most important word was respect. You're going to try to show respect for people on different sides of heated. Now you say, well, does that mean showing respect for racists who are running over people in cars? Well, no, it does mean that if you're going to quote them, you're going to quote them accurately so that listeners and readers actually know what they think. Some people years ago had said if more people had quoted Hitler accurately and extensively, the rest of the world would have been warned to some degree by what was really coming. But people said, God, he's just crazy. Nothing will come of this. Something came of it. So to some degree, quoting the far, far, far right, you're supposed to do it accurately. You're supposed to take their views seriously, is kind of like trying to quote the far left. The question, especially the far left that advocates violence, and the crucial point at the center of this debate about the Cotton Peace, to me, was all perfectly summed up by the fact that they said he was advocating using the National Guard and troops against peaceful protesters. And when they first spoke out against this and then ran a piece justifying why they had printed a 330-word correction and why we had all of this fallout, they actually misquoted Cotton's piece and later went back in and corrected the error without admitting they had made an error. So just so that people know what we're talking about, here is the crucial section of the Cotton piece. Outnumbered police officers, encumbered by feckless politicians, bore the brunt of the violence. In New York State, rioters ran over officers with cars on at least three occasions. In Las Vegas, an officer is in grave condition after being shot in the head by a rioter. In St. Louis, four police officers were shot as they attempted to disperse a mob, throwing bricks and dumping gasoline. In a separate incident, a 77-year-old retired police captain, an African-American, by the way, was shot to death as he tried to stop looters from ransacking a pawn shop. This is somebody's granddaddy, a bystander screamed at the scene. Here's the big section. Some elites have excused this orgy of violence in the spirit of radical chic, calling it an understandable response to the wrongful death of George Floyd. Those excuses are built on a revolting moral equivalence of rioters and looters to peaceful, law-abiding protesters. A majority who seek to protest peacefully shouldn't be confused with bands of miscreants. Throughout the piece, Senator Cotton was very clear in saying that the protesters have First Amendment rights, they should be protected, their views should be taken seriously, In some cases, he probably would argue they need permits for certain types of protests, but he's not confusing the protesters with the rioters. And when he talks about using the National Guard as a backstop to police, he's dealing with rioters and looters, not dealing with protesters and the First Amendment rights of protesters. So, to some degree, the entire rebellion was rooted on a misunderstanding or a misquoting of part of what Cotton said, when in reality, it seemed like several hundred people at the New York Times simply didn't want a sitting U.S. senator to be able to write an op-ed page piece, which he was approached by the Times to do it, to write an op-ed page piece in which he advocated what many, I've seen polls saying as much as, you know, between 50 and 70% of the U.S. public thought that it was appropriate to use the National Guard as a backstop to prevent additional violence, the key, predicting violence. A person I really respect, David French, and several others, made an interesting observation. He said that the military operates under extremely strict codes of how it can use force when dealing with these kinds of situations. And they made a case that many Americans actually at this point might trust the safety of having the National Guard on the scene, safety to citizens, safety to protesters, even safety to the rioters, that having the National Guard there might actually be better than having police if the local police departments had shown a consistent lack of ability to control the actions, the out-of-control actions of some cops. And in some cases, I would note, if they were operating under union contracts that offered extraordinary protection to officers in terms of not being held accountable in some cases for acts of violence. Now, that's a very confusing situation, but the point, again, is the newsroom was protesting the op-ed page that it published this conservative op-ed, and they were even misquoting the op-ed in order to justify attacking it. Very interesting. The other thing listeners may not know is the term op-ed has several meanings. One is you have the editorial page that speaks for the editorial staff and writers of the newspaper. Then you have opposite that, the op-ed page piece. And what you run on the op-ed frequently is pieces that are the opposite, and not just in terms of location, from the views of the editorial pages. So in this case, publishing a piece by a conservative Republican senator, lawyer, etc., is exactly what the op-ed is supposed to do. It doesn't mean it speaks for the paper. It says exactly the opposite. This is a different point of view from the viewpoint of the paper, but we think our readers need to hear about it.
Weren't the seeds of this, in essence, planted by the executive editor of the New York Times, Dean Baquet, when I think in, not coincidentally, 2016, he kind of became more lenient with the newsroom in allowing the expression of opinion in news?
Well, a lot of this has to do with social media and trying to control social media and a changing of the guard in terms of the age of some of the people who work at the Times. And the Times, of course, draws the vast majority of its staff from extremely elite educational institutions in the Northeast. So this is the all-star team of the academic blue zip codes, would be one way to think about it. But I think it's crucial, if you pay attention to Get Religion, I think it's crucial to flash back further than the episode of 216, even though there is important content there. You may remember, we've talked about it before, that the public editor of the New York Times, Liz Spaed, ended up being let go or fired, and she's the former editor of the Columbia Journalism Review, very liberal. She was basically let go due to a revolt among the staff who didn't like her saying, you know, that it was bad for the paper to miss the rise of Donald Trump. B, it raised the ultimate question of whether the New York Times was already too liberal to accurately cover half of America. And by that, she means the nation was split almost 50-50 between Hillary Clinton voters and Donald Trump voters, blue zip codes with higher populations versus big areas of lowly populated, red zip codes in flyover country. Liz Spayed wrote column after column, frequently quoting liberals, in which they said they were disappointed that the Times no longer seemed to be interested in people on the other side of these issues. Well, if you read Get Religion, doesn't that sound kind of familiar? Because that takes us back to the famous remarks that I wrote a column about by the editor Bill Keller at the University of Texas at the Lyndon Baines Library, where, if you'll recall, he was asked point blank, is the New York Times a liberal newspaper? And he famously said that he thought the paper was doing a good job being neutral and old school in the coverage of politics. But then he said, yeah, we're liberal. I'm directly quoting now. We are liberal in the sense that we're open-minded, sort of tolerant, urban. Our wedding page includes, and did even before New York had a gay marriage law, included gay unions. So we're liberal in that sense of the word, I guess, socially liberal. And then the moderator of this forum said, does that mean you slant the coverage to favor Democrats and liberals? And Keller, who had just stepped down as executive editor of the Times, just a normal retirement, not stepping down because of controversy, he said, aside from the liberal values, sort of social values thing I talked about, no, I don't think that it does. And I've always argued that the words aside from represented a landmark moment in the history of the New York Times, because he was basically saying we struggle to keep our biases out of coverage of religious, moral, and cultural issues. But other than that, we're fine. We don't have any trouble covering politics. We're doing great there. But we have trouble with these cultural and religious issues, which led me to rather dryly write, and what are the hot-button social issues in American life? Quote, any list would have to include sex, salvation, abortion, euthanasia, gay rights, cloning, and a few other sensitive matters that are inevitably linked to religion. That's all.
Terry Mattingly is our guest. We're talking about media coverage of recent resignations at the New York Times. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation, and we'll talk about how maybe a different kind of religion is ruling the roost at the New York Times, one called progressivism. The Boy Who Was Lost, The Beggar's Greatest Wish, The Unforgiving Servant. These are some of the 12 stories that you'll find in the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for June, Archbook's Treasury, Life of Jesus. Learn more about this resource for children, grandchildren, and godchildren, ages 5 through 9, at issuesetc.org, or call Concordia Publishing House and request the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for June, Archbook's Treasury, Life of Jesus, 1-800-325-3040.
Looking for a foreign language program that will revolutionize your students' vocabulary knowledge and their understanding of grammar? How about a program that teaches critical thinking skills, too? Look no further than Memoria Press's Latin curriculum. Students of all ages can use these Latin study programs. Give your students the gift of Latin today. To order, visit memoriapress.com and save $5 on your next order by using the coupon code LPR20. Memoria Press, saving Western civilization one student at a time.
Listen to what you want, when you want. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
The Church's Music from the 20th Century. The 17th Century. The 11th Century. The 8th Century. The 4th Century. The best of the Church's music from the past 2,000 years. LutheranPublicRadio.org.
We're liberal in the sense that the liberal arts schools are liberal. We're an urban newspaper. We write about evolution as a fact. We don't give equal time to creationism. We are liberal in the sense that we are open-minded, sort of tolerant, urban. Our weddings page includes, and did even before New York had a gay marriage law, included gay unions. So we're liberal in that sense of the word, I guess.
So I'll ask you directly, and you can answer directly, does the New York Times have bias in favor of Democrats or liberals?
Aside from the liberal values, sort of social values thing that I talked about, no, I don't think it does.
That's Bill Keller, formerly the executive editor of the New York Times, with what Terry Mattingly calls his Kellerism. We're talking about media coverage of recent resignations at the New York Times. Terry Mattingly is our guest, senior fellow at the Overby Center at the University of Mississippi, author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate, and the book Pop Goes Religion, and he's founder and editor of Get Religion. So, Terry, you had asked me earlier about my reaction when I'd seen the backlash to Tom Cotton's op-ed piece in the New York Times. And my second thought was the kind of uniformity of response almost had a creedal tone to it. We're all going to recite the same thing. And this is how my mind works. I jumped to the notion that this is almost a religious tenet now that must be obeyed, and that religion could be called progressivism. What are your thoughts?
I don't know what the term progressive means. I do know, because I've been writing about it now for 20 years almost, we have a problem right now with the word liberal. And the clash over the Cotton op-ed really points this out. The way you've heard me say it before, let me restate it for listeners. I've asked the question repeatedly at Get Religion, what do we call someone who is weak in their defense of free speech, weak in their defense of freedom of association, and weak in their defense of religious liberty? You know, the basic First Amendments, freedom of the press would obviously be in there as well. The classic First Amendment questions that have always been at the heart of American liberalism. So what do you call someone who no longer is defending core beliefs of liberalism? You cannot accurately call them a liberal. Now, this is where we need to pause and really think about this. You could say that what happened here this week or a week ago was that somebody threw out the liberals, that the older generation of Times thinkers and editorial writers were comfortable with that Bill Keller kind of unstated liberalism on moral and social issues, but still believed that they were preaching the old religion of journalism when it comes to politics and whatever. In a wonderful piece called Journalism is Itself a Religion, I say wonderful in that it's clearly stated, a professor at NYU, New York University, Jay Rosen, and he was writing a piece about a website that was directly competing with Get Religion. And he quoted one of my columns in which I took me and a person I was interviewing took umbrage with a New York Times statement where someone had said, we believe that there's no such thing as absolutes, and anybody who believes in absolute truths is crazy. And Rosen stated, he said that I was pointing out that that sounded awfully religious. And he stated the old religion of journalism kind of as the orthodoxy of no orthodoxy. In other words, it's an absolute truth that there's no absolute truths. So our orthodoxy is that there can't be an orthodoxy. Now, when you have that kind of a belief, you're open to printing all sorts of points of view. You should be very open to debates between people on both sides. You want to hear all, because you're saying kind of like Star Trek, you know, we're not going to judge what anybody believes and with the cultural, you know, mandate or whatever. We're not going to overthrow people's point of view. We're going to have good arguments. And that's what our newspaper is about. Accurate coverage of good arguments. That's the old liberalism. But what you're reacting to is that what happened here? Or did some people say, forget the orthodoxy of no orthodoxy? We're saying to the editorial page, there is an orthodoxy, and you broke it. And by even publishing this piece, even though we are inaccurately quoting it, by even publishing this piece, you are endangering reporters from the New York Times. And that's very much the language right now of the contemporary college and university campus, which is, if you say something that I disagree with about sexuality, now about race and about a host of other things, I don't disagree with you. I believe that you are hurting and threatening me and that you are committing violent speech and violent ideas. You are literally committing thought crimes against me. Well, is that liberalism? That's the big question we have to ask. And if it's not liberalism, what is it? Progressivism is the words that's being used. But for journalists, what we're seeing now, Kellerism, which covered religious, moral, and social issues, is now spreading into politics and into other subjects. I noticed that one of the people leading the revolt at the Times was a business editor, a section of the paper that normally is associated with the most neutral and dry factual of coverage, because you're covering business trends and people are trying to invest money based on this information. What do we call this new form of journalism? Well, it's basically European advocacy journalism, the way you would see it at the New Republic or on the right at National Review. You're saying, we already know what the truth is. Now we're going to offer you coverage that shows you what you already believe, and we're going to demonstrate that we can defend the truth. Well, that's not old school liberal American journalism. It's the return of an older model of the press, the European model of the press. And we've seen it in religion coverage, I would argue, for 20-something years. One of the first major pieces written about this was by a previous public editor at the New York Times, Daniel Akrent, in 2014, who wrote a 2004, 16 years ago, wrote a piece with the headline, "Is the New York Times a liberal newspaper?" He said, of course it is. But as he got to the bottom, he got into this issue. No, it seems like our paper is now advocating a specific political, moral, and cultural point of view. And we're telling half of America, you are wrong, and your points of view are not worthy of journalism and accurate coverage. The Cotton piece said they're not even worthy of being on the op-ed page.
With about a minute here, Terry, is this, you think, a permanent change, this blurring of news and opinion?
I would say that the internet is pushing us in that direction, because the internet isn't good for broad-based audiences. It's great for creating choirs of similarly believing people who live in concrete bunkers and only listen to the news they want to hear, that the things they already believe. But I will say that until we find out what the internet is going to become as an advertising venue, as a venue for ideas in general, I don't think that we know where the internet is going to end up pushing us. So I have a little bit of hope about that. But right now, I would say the European model of the press is firmly in control at the New York Times, and it appears that's going to impact everything or almost everything that's in the paper. And that is a tragedy for American public discourse and, above all, for journalism.
Terry Mattingly is senior fellow at the Overby Center at the University of Mississippi. He's author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate and the book Pop Goes Religion. He's founder and editor of Get Religion. Terry, talk with you next week.
Glad to do so.
Eric Hiller joins us on the other side of the break. We're going to talk about higher education post-COVID. In the short term, of course, it means kids staying home rather than going off to college or university, learning online. How many of the changes short term will translate into the long term? We'll answer that question next.
Week on the Word of the Lord Endures Forever, our romp through Romans continues. The glory of God's children revealed groans too deep for words. No separation anxiety. Israel's glory and God's choice. Join me, Pastor Will Wheaton, for the Word of the Lord Endures Forever, your daily 15-minute verse-by-verse Bible study on demand at thewordendures.org and on the Lutheran Public Radio app.
Our cities are some of the greatest mission fields on the planet, but the footprint of the church is shrinking. We dare not shrink from our cities. Christ is needed now in our urban areas. From chaos, turmoil, decay, death, and destruction, Jesus brings peace, hope, resurrection, eternal life, and rebuilding. And you can help by being a hero for the city. Find out how at lcms.org/citymission or on Facebook at LCMS City Mission. Every city needs a hero. Capes and helmets not required.
Have you ever wondered if your investments could do more? I mean, a whole lot more? This is Rahema Kavuga, Synod Relations Manager of Lutheran Church Extension Fund. When you invest with us, you not only earn a competitive interest rate, but your investment goes to strengthen Lutheran Church Missouri Synod church workers, congregations, schools, and organizations through low-cost loans and services. To learn more, visit lcef.org/invest101.
Our life together as the church after COVID-19 will bring new challenges. For example, we might be tempted to skip the regular gathering of God's people because we're more comfortable streaming it on Facebook instead. May it not be. Join the Reverend Dr. Mark Wood as he explores this theme in his article for the June-July issue of the Lutheran Witness titled, Gathering Again, It Will Not Be the Same. Subscribe at cph.org/witness, The Lutheran Witness, Interpreting the Contemporary World from a Lutheran Perspective, cph.org/witness.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
I like to think of the deaconess vocation as driven by two things, the love of Christ and the needs of our neighbor.
Issues, Etc. regular guest, Dr. James Buescher, Director of Deaconess Studies at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, on the vocation of deaconess.
First, the deaconess is moved by the love of Christ, who came not to be served, but to serve. Yet I think we can also see the profound needs around us, broken families, loneliness, despair. Deaconesses help the church to become a true family that manifests the love of Christ in our love for one another, and especially for those in need.
For more information on the Deaconess Studies program at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, visit ctsfw.edu or call Concordia Theological Seminary at 1-800-481-2155, 800-481-2155.